Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 26th of March 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at radioalbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II and also the soon-to-be-finalised Churchill's Body Count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good evening, sir. Yeah, fine, thank you.
Excellent.
Another bad week. Little mini miracle. Well, I can't wait to that at this stage.
Well, that's good. Well, we're just really glad to have you back. You know, we were so worried when you weren't here all that time and not hearing from you. And you know, so many people were coming into the chat room and leaving comments and trying to contact me on Telegram as well. Yeah. It's just... you know, it's wonderful to have you back. And I did miss talking to you every week as well because, you know, how long have you been doing this now?
My wife's never said that to me.
Yeah, 7 years. 7 years Radio Albion's been going. So we must have been, you know, making podcasts together for that length of time.
I found you on Radio Albion the other week, last week's podcast.
Yeah, well, we started off...
Still up and running.
Well, we started off as Radio Stormer, didn't we? And then Radio Aryan, and then Radio Albion. And what was the first one? Behind the Reich.
With our friend from Belgium who's gone missing.
Yeah, well, Messerschmidt. Yeah, he's disappeared. Yeah, that's a shame. He's still around. He's just lying low for some reason. It would be great to see him make some more videos out of the Axis War Heroes series that we did, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we've got that, enjoy that.
People can find them at the Radio Albion site. They are in the sidebar there. And also in the sidebar there, we have an advert for Truth Will Out Films. And if you click on that little box there, it will take you to moneytreepublishing.com and you're able to buy a DVD of The Greatest Story Never Told.
I think Communism by the Back Door is due out anytime.
Due out anytime soon. Excellent. And that will also be from Money Tree Publishing. And if people purchase them from there, some of the money goes to you, Dennis, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's been a long time before I got anything. I never asked for donations. But what money was coming before from the other website was cut off with PayPal, just like everybody else we suffered.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years since you've been able to get any income from your films. Yeah. And you've always put the films out for free as well, haven't you?
I was out for free, you know, someone once queried me over it, and I said, it must be the worst business decision ever made, because I can get you at least 10 sites where you can go and find it, and he apologised after. He just thought, I was selling it and not telling the story.
Well, that's the thing is, if people like watching the documentaries, then they're naturally going to want to donate to the guy that made the documentaries, aren't they? So then they can buy a copy of it. I think it's...
Yeah. I mean, somebody give me... Like I said, don't normally get donations, but somebody give me a fair whack for coming in by the back door once. If he's listening, thank you very much. But it was a fair whack. I even said to him, are you sure?
Well, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. It's nice to know people appreciate your work. And also, I mean, it's information that you want to get out there. We want as many people as possible to... understand what's going on and
the understand reason, what's going on here at the end of
the day. Yeah, the reason why things are the way they are. And that's part of this series that we do here, Truthful Out Radio, looking back over history and trying to find out where we've been lied to or where there's a different story there that perhaps we're not told.
Yeah, in every corner.
Yeah, and there's definitely one that we're going to be talking about tonight. It's part two of our series on Jewish immigration in the Third Reich tonight, which is a book that was written by Ingrid Weckert. And we're going to be using her book, plus we've got some notes here, and we'll also be discussing it as well. And I'll just start by reiterating the reason for this discussion on Jewish emigration in the Third Reich. And this is what Ingrid Weckert has to say. She says, emigration was not some kind of wild flight, but rather a lawfully determined and regulated matter, and the purpose of this work is to elucidate the emigration process in law and policy, thereby augmenting the traditionally received picture of Jewish emigration from Germany. Because it's not something that really gets talked about. When it does get talked about, it usually isn't accurate. And so she dug up all the primary documents, looked at all the source material, and she compiled it all together so that she could tell the story of how the Jews actually were able to leave from Germany during the war. Because there's this idea that they were being kept in there, or they weren't being allowed out. And in actual fact, they were encouraged to emigrate, and they were helped in a lot of ways.
I think in The Great Story Never Told, that was one of the biggest shocks in the documentary to a lot of people, because when we fed this, they were kicked out of the church, you know what I mean?
Well, it's quite clear they were able to take their possessions with them once we look into this. And also, before you exposed it all in Greatest Story Never Told, Ernst Zundel did as well, didn't he? There was a book that was written about it, the Havara Agreement, and it was sort of forgotten about, and he helped to popularise it again, didn't he?
The man, yeah.
I think it may have been written about in Yiddish and sort of published in Israel, but it wasn't really known in the English-speaking world.
In order to keep these things, they don't actually lie, just keep it under wraps. But even today, I talked to some people every now and again on the internet, and they refuse to believe that it ever took place and that Hitler did kick him out, which is completely untrue.
And Ken Livingstone brought it up, didn't he? And he was...
Yeah, he did, yeah, for a play. And he got walloped for it as well, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, totally castigated. But in the end, they had to admit that he hadn't said anything untrue. But they still called him anti-Semitic for saying it. But he was basically just saying, well, Hitler did work with the Zionists. That is a fact.
Did he watch the documentary?
Be good if he did. I would hope that he did.
Yeah.
Well, let's begin with a recap of what we were talking about last week. On March the 24th, 1933, 2 months after the National Socialists took power, World Jewry, as it referred to itself, declared war on Germany, which caused Germany's Jews to be put under suspicion. This also put extreme pressure on the new administration, as all exports and imports were banned. Yet Hitler still managed to get 6 million people back to work by cutting out the need for international banks to issue money. Because World Jewry had designated Germany's Jews as enemy forces, Germany decided to help any Jews in Germany that wanted to leave. And the Jewish community was split into two groups. One identified with Germany and was just Jewish by religion, and the other saw Judaism as both a religion and an identity. And the Zionists were part of the second group. And at first they were just a minority, but by about the time the war came, they were the majority by that time. And we heard how many Jews were not distrustful of the National Socialist state, and they were loyal to Germany. And some, such as Dr. Max Neumann, were very much against what they saw as foreign Jews, those who were Zionist and saw themselves as Jews first and Germans second. And these were really the ones that the National Socialists didn't want to support, surprisingly enough. They didn't want the Jews to see themselves as German. They wanted the Jews to see themselves as Jews and be proud of that identity. So they had more of an alliance with the Zionist type of Jew than the assimilated Jew. And in 1931, there were even National Socialist Jews. And when the Nuremberg Laws came in, the religious Jews very much approved of them, as they meant that Jews could only marry other Jews and would be living amongst their own again, which is, of course, in accordance with Jewish law. And if you look at the laws that they have in the state of Israel, some of them parallel the Nuremberg Laws. And that's where we got to last week, Dennis. Is there anything that you remember from that? You want to say anything?
No, I was just thinking then about the problem is with America today, this dual citizenship, which many have, they belong to one country or another. But most of them in America who have got dual citizenship hold Israel before their own country.
One of them has just admitted that, hasn't he? I think he's Yeah, I think his name is Pollard, and he was an American with dual citizenship, an American Jew, and he spied on America, and he gave Israel all the nuclear secrets, and he was locked up for decades, and then I think he was pardoned by Donald Trump, and he went back to Israel a couple of months back, and there's pictures of Bibi Netanyahu welcoming him like he's a famous son of Israel, and this guy spied on his host nation. He was a traitor to America.
I remember him now, actually, yeah.
He was held up as a hero, and he's just done an interview, and he says, all of us with dual loyalty, Israel is always going to come first. You're always going to be a Jew first. And he's just said that. I think it might have been in Haaretz or one of the Jewish newspapers.
I believe it as well, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's just common sense, isn't it?
Well, he's better off going with Israel, you know, rather than spying on his own country.
They're going to be loyal to their own people the same way as you are going to be loyal to your own family. Doesn't mean you hate other families or anything like that, but you are going to be loyal to your own family first, and you're going to be loyal to your own nation first, and the Jews are loyal to their own nation first. And I can't criticise them for that. Well, I can criticise.
I can when Rothschilds, I mean, Israel is Rothschilds, and with what they've done throughout centuries, I can't really agree with that.
What you can criticise is white people for not realising this and not working this out, that people are going to be loyal to their own. You know, that's the problem. Not the Jews having loyalty to other Jews. Well, let's get into immigration here. For the Zionists, the only viable future was in their own country, the former Palestine. Of course, it wasn't actually their country just yet. They needed to move back there and settle it. But even for them, it was unimaginable that all the Jews would leave Germany. They wanted to win over the younger Jews for emigration so that they could do all the heavy work in Palestine. In order to bring this about, they realised that working together with the National Socialists was the only alternative for their organisations. And that is what happened. Over the following years, an ever closer positive relationship with the National Socialists developed among those Jews who wished to immigrate to Palestine. German institutions were desirous of concluding the emigration as quickly as possible, but as noted earlier, the other Jewish groups and organisations realised the necessity of emigration only gradually. So right at the start, the Zionists were very keen to do this, and they wanted the younger Jews to go over there first because they wanted them to do the work. Now, Palestine was in the hands of the British at the time. And I have heard interviews with British people from that time, and they say that Britain did loads of work over there, built railways and all sorts, because it was seen as Britain needed to advance this country so that it moved into the civilised world, because it had been in the hands of the Ottomans until the end of the First World War. And the Germans also really helped in this. And as we'll see here, but when you look the page up on Wikipedia, it doesn't tell you anything about the British doing any of the building work or the Germans doing any of the building work. And I'm not saying the Jews didn't do any, because I think it would have been the very best of the Jews that went out there, because they would have been the ones that wanted to work, wanted to build, wanted to do the farming. But it's actually covered up that the British and the Germans actually did help quite a lot to build the country up. Do you want to say anything about this?
Well, I was just going to say maybe somebody out there in radio land knows, but I could never find out, because as we understand it, Nazi is a derogatory term, but they made I think it was Goebbels who wrote the book, A Nazi in Palestine, and they commemorated a coin with Nazi written on the back, and I never got to the bottom of that one.
I think that was produced, as you say, it was produced, it was a commemorative coin, and I think it was Goebbels, it was either Goebbels or somebody else, another high-up journalist, that went out to Palestine to see how it was all going and to see how the Jews were building the place up and were building the businesses up.
Well, that one went out, didn't it?
Yeah, that was a commemorative coin that was struck. Yeah.
But why the word Nazi? That's what I could never find out.
And possibly because it means prince in Hebrew.
Yeah, but obviously in German it was used as a derogatory term, and yet the are using on the coin. That's just kind of puzzled me. I couldn't get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. It's a derogatory term in Germany, and it was a derogatory term in English, and yet this coin had wording on it in Yiddish, I think, and then it had the word Nazi, and Nazi in Yiddish means prince.
Right, well, it was just, I think on one side were German, on one side were Yiddish, from what I can remember anyway, I might be wrong.
Well, there you go.
It is a weird one.
Well, that's one explanation that I would suggest might be the reason for it, because it is strange that they would use a derogatory term for it. And it's strange enough that, you know, we have that anyway, with a Jewish star on one side of it and a swastika on the other.
Yeah, that is weird, is it? Again, isn't it?
Well, there were three agencies. There were three Jewish emigration agencies which had in part operated in Berlin since the beginning of the century. The Hilfsverein für Deutsche Juden was responsible for emigration to all parts of the world except for Palestine. It maintained agents in foreign countries who investigated the possibilities of immigration and settlement, i.e. accommodating German Jews and establishing contact with local Jewish organisations, thereby making it easier for the immigrants to settle down. The Palestine office, the Palestinamt, concerned itself with the Aliyah, literally the ascending, meaning the ascent to Jerusalem, synonymous for immigration to Palestine. Its clients were above all young Jews who were suitable for the hard physical labour that settlement in Palestine brought with it. And a third institution was the main office for Jewish migration welfare, the Hauptstelle für Jüdische Wanderversorge. Initially, this agency concerned itself with Jews who were travelling in Germany, and later this organisation concerned itself with caring for and resettling non-German Jews. So you got three there. You've got one for the Jews that want to go to Palestine, one for the Jews that want to go everywhere else, and one for Jews that are in Germany that aren't actually German Jews. And that was the one that expanded, I guess, to look after Jews in occupied countries and help them to move to other places.
Yeah. That's another thing which we uncovered, the fact that if a Jew had been in an area under Nazi occupation or in Germany, even before the war started, they're entitled to a Holocaust pension, even if they spent the war on a beach in Florida, which is another weird one.
Well, another side of this that Jews will mention is, and they're quite correct in mentioning it, other countries did not want to accept these Jews.
No, they didn't. We said that last week, yeah.
They were saying, you know, we would like to move out of Germany, and we would like to go anywhere else, but these other countries were saying, well, we don't want them.
So, Team America.
It was only after the war that they went to America. And maybe part of that was to encourage them to go to Israel, go to Palestine. So you got a home.
I don't think Hitler looked on a homeland for the Jews in a really positive light when he's saying that he expects wherever they are to be a haven for the criminals of the world. And to be fair, if a Israeli is on the run from America, he lands in Israel, they'll never deport him.
Yeah, they don't have any extradition treaties with anywhere else. And again, that's a policy that I think is a good policy.
That's fair play. Yeah. I mean, America had one similar with the. There was an accident, wasn't there? There was an embassy, a woman, I think, was killed, or her son was killed, I can't remember. And they wanted America to send the woman, I think she was the wife of a diplomat, send her back to Britain so she could stand trial, and Trump refused. And I knew he would, and now they're putting pressure on Biden. I don't think Biden's going to do that. It's just, the Americans are Americans. You know, they won't leave anybody behind, and they'll send people back.
Yeah, they're looking after their people. I think what plays into that as well is the diplomatic side of it. I think the woman herself was actually a diplomat, so she came under that diplomatic immunity. And when you think about it, like if you get injured at work or something happens to you at work, it's work that pays out the compensation and does everything. And when they're over here in Britain, they're at work, so they're effectively on American soil. And they're being cared for by America rather than coming under British law.
I believe when the parents of the victim went over to America, they were actually in the White House, and the woman that wanted extradition was in the next room, but they refused to see her because Trump said I can bring her out, but didn't want to see her.
I feel really sorry for the mother of her son that got run over, and I think she's sure. I think she's fallen in with a really bad lawyer. That lawyer she had just hated Donald Trump, and he was giving her all sorts of false hopes and saying, oh, yeah, it doesn't matter, diplomatic law. The moral of this is that she should stand trial in Britain. Well, that's no advice to give to someone. That's not legal advice. No. I think she was really let down by him, and she missed that chance to actually find out what was behind that when Trump said, you can speak to the woman. She's next door. I've arranged this for you.
Yeah, that's why the police never entered the Ecuador embassy. They just camped outside and spent about £6 million on cameras. But there's a, you know, there must be some kind of a contract or a treaty which that grounds Ecuador's or whoever embassy it is. That is the country's grounds.
Yeah, that's the way it's worked, and it's worked like that for thousands of years. You know, your embassy with another country, and you have representatives of that country in your country, you can't then go trying to catch them out with your laws. They are above the law, effectively, because their country is responsible for it. So we could go to war against America for it, but we couldn't really go against the woman herself as an individual.
Unless you're in Benghazi.
Yeah, I guess. Well, moving on here, the National Socialist Government attempted to promote the emigration of its unwanted Jewish citizens, and two principal agreements were used by the state to regulate the emigration. The Havarah Agreement and the Rubley-Wolfat Agreement. The Havarah Agreement was in force from 1933 until 1941, and it concerned emigration to Palestine. This agreement is now regularly mentioned in the relevant literature. In 1972, the former director of the Havarah Agreement, Werner Felchenfeld, self-published a brochure which has obviously not been read by most people who write about the Havarah. Otherwise, they might not write so much nonsense about it. The Rubley-Wolfat Agreement, on the other hand, generally falls under the historical blackout. It covered the majority of emigrating Jews, all those who did not go to Palestine, but went to other European countries or overseas countries, and that was about two-thirds of all the migrants. Unfortunately, this agreement operated for only 8 months. Then war broke out, and regulated emigration came to a stop. We note this point here because it makes clear the intentions of the German government, which were far removed from the, quote, extermination of the Jews, close quote. So you can see that they're making every effort that they can to help these Jews to actually move out of Germany. And once the war started, they were unable to get the Jews out to other European countries. But as we'll see, even once the war started, the Germans were still helping the illegal immigration into Palestine. Which,
do you know what? I mean, the problem is, was the communists. Can you remember the rabbi who made a video and stated that he'd never heard of the massacres in Russia? Because he said this is why Hitler hated the Jews. I don't really remember it or not. A couple of years back. So a lot of them have been kept in the dark on certain things.
Yeah, oh yeah, I do remember that. I do remember that video. I remember you highlighting it. These rabbis saying, look, Hitler was right. The Jews were doing this in Russia. And this is what the Soviets were doing. And they were predominantly Jewish. And this is what Hitler was talking about. And this is what this rabbi was saying. But also, I was looking into this today, and it turns out that the Soviets actually torpedoed lots of these Jewish refugees that were on their way to Palestine.
There's a surprise.
Yeah, just discovered that today. I tell you, there's a lot of intrigue with this Jewish immigration into Palestine that we'll hear about here. That really surprised me to hear about.
A lot of it in history.
A lot of it. In February 1933, Palestinian representatives of the citrus growing company Hanatea Limited approached the German government to explore ways of realising their mutual interests. For the Germans, the immigration of Jews, and for the Jewish Palestinians, the immigration of Jews. The Jewish side attempted to get advantageous immigration conditions that would benefit Palestine. The German authorities accepted the Jewish proposals. And in May 1933, the first accords on economic policy were signed. These formed the basis of the Havarah Agreement. The word Havarah is Hebrew for transfer, i.e. to transport or transfer, in this case, the transfer of wealth and goods. It is by this Hebrew name that the agreement became known in the German records. So it wasn't just Jews that were going to Palestine, as you know, this fleeing Jew who's had all his belongings stolen from him by the Germans. They were able to transfer all their wealth, all their goods, all the things that were needed in Palestine. They were importing from Germany. That even actually upset the people in Palestine because they wanted to make their own stuff, and they were able to get hold of all this German stuff. And it's also upset the British because the British were wanting to sell their goods in Palestine, which we'll get into. But we can see here that the German authorities are working with the Jews, and this is advantageous for everyone, basically. It was a good deal all around that they had negotiated here. It was only stopped by the war. Do you want to add anything, Dennis?
I'm muted. Apologies. No, Einstein, I was going to say, was one of the leading Zionists as well.
Yeah, he was very keen for Jews to move to Israel. He was keen for there to be Jewish nationalism, but he wasn't very keen for any other country to have nationalism, no. Was he? Bit of a hypocrite. The Havarah provided for the following arrangement. Jews who wished to migrate to Palestine could deposit their money into one or more accounts of Jewish banks in Germany. They could make such deposits even if they remained in Germany for the foreseeable future, i.e. even if they had just merely the intention of emigrating from Germany. And basically what that means, the money was safe there. They could put the money in the Jewish bank and it was safe. They could then use this money for the benefit of any Jewish settlers already in Palestine, or they could invest the money in Palestine. They were also able to pay their medical insurance out of this money up to 10 years in advance. German Jews thereby received rights that German Reich citizens did not enjoy. Falkenfeld writes, "Preparations for a home in Palestine for those still in Germany were a breakthrough as regards the currency controls prohibition that applied to Germans investing overseas." So remember, World Jewry has declared war on Germany, and what that meant was that there were restrictions on finances. They couldn't use any foreign currency, they couldn't exchange currency with any countries, they couldn't invest overseas or anything like that. There was an exception made here for these German Jews. German Jews had more rights here than the Germans did because they could send their money to Palestine. Germans couldn't send their money anywhere they wanted to in the world. But if you were a Jew, you were able to send it to Palestine. So what they're saying here is, you know, Germany was not abusing the Jews here. They were helping them to be able to invest their money abroad.
To be honest, I don't think it's very wise for countries to leave the money in all these banks, as happened in Libya, where they seized the assets of Libya in the war and spent $500 million funding those invading to get the government overturned.
Yeah, nobody knows what happened to that Libyan sovereign wealth fund. Was it $5 billion?
So massive, weren't it? I think Clinton's and the Obamas had the little bit, I think, with the vast majority. That's no idea.
I can recall it being on the news. They've frozen the funds. They said, "Oh, we've frozen Gaddafi's bank account." But the actual news was the Libyan sovereign wealth fund was frozen.
Yeah, and stolen.
Yeah, I don't believe that was ever given. That hasn't been given back to them because they say, "Well, it's not a stable enough situation." So all that wealth, disappeared.
But just an example, isn't it, of the control that the banks have over countries.
A traveller's credit agreement in cooperation with a travel agency in Tel Aviv was built into the Havarah agreement. It enabled prospective German Jews to journey to Palestine to find out what opportunities the country offered. They paid their expenses in Reichsmarks and in Palestine received vouchers for all the incurred costs. This as well was an exceptional provision. Due to strict foreign currency regulations, it was almost impossible for Germans to travel outside of Germany. But these tours, organised by the Kraft durch Freude, the Strength Through Joy, an organisation which offered affordable cruises to German workers and their families, were settled by clearances. So I bet you weren't aware of that. It was the Strength Through Joy ships that were actually taking the Jews to Palestine for a little holiday.
Yeah, it's pretty ironic, really, because after the World War finished, a couple of years after, the Jews were taking German ships to the West Indies and bringing the West Indies over to England.
Well, yeah, that's what happened, wasn't it? The SS, yeah. I forget what it was, that they turned into the Windrush, didn't they?
That's a long, ironic.
And also these Strength Through Joy ships, they weren't allowed to dock in Britain, were they, because of these
No, because the word got round that somehow there's a better life. It wouldn't be welcomed by our ruling elite.
Yeah, well, it was all over. And also because of this trade embargo as well, and yet the Jews were exempt from that. Or the Germans managed to fix it so that the Jews were exempt from that, and they could travel to Palestine, see what the place was like, come back to Germany and get their belongings together, and then they could head off to Palestine. Nothing like them escaping out from under barbed wire with only the shirt on their backs, is it?
It's yeah. Well, I mean, I was shocked when I first learned of it myself doing the documentary. And I think last week I mentioned that the guy who wrote the book, Black, the author is called, who is a Jew himself in the mid-1980s, and his parents disowned him for revealing it.
For talking about this?
Edwin Black, yeah.
Just for making this trip. I think I might have seen that author's name as I was looking through Google Images for some images for this. I type in Havarah Agreement, and there's a couple of books that appear. Well, once ready to emigrate, individuals received from their German bank, according to the exchange value, the minimum amount of foreign currency needed, which was 1,000 Palestinian pounds. And the value of the Palestinian pound was equal to that of the English pound sterling. The Israeli historian Avraham Barkai has stressed that given the prevailing foreign currency regulations, this allocation of foreign currency exclusively to emigrating Jewish citizens was a marked exception. So again, you've got no foreign exchanges are allowed, but the Jews are allowed to exchange their money for 1,000 Palestinian pounds. And upon entering Palestine, the Jews from Germany had to show this money. And a study of some years ago interpreted the £1,000 required for entry as payment for an entry visa. This is complete nonsense. The money was theirs, and they were only required to present it in order to demonstrate that they were able to support themselves and to create a new life so as not to burden the Jewish community in Palestine. The rest of their money remained at their disposal in their Havara account. And this is the same thing they have in Britain today, isn't it? I think you're supposed to have £5,000 if you want to emigrate into Britain to show that you can pay for yourself.
Probably, but I think there's a limit on how much money you can take out of both Britain and America. You're not allowed to take a vast amount out.
I don't think there were any limits on this. It doesn't say that there were any limits. The more money, the better, really, because it meant that more money was going into Palestine, to this Jewish community. It doesn't say anything about there being any limits on this. I had heard that this £1,000 was taken off them once they got to Palestine. It may even say that on Wikipedia about it being an entry visa, but according to this, it wasn't an entry visa, and it was a requirement that the Jewish community themselves demanded.
You know, we don't believe Wikipedia, do we?
Yeah, well, what this Jewish community was saying is we want Jews to come here, but we don't want Jews with no money to come here.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there's a debunking of the Great Story Never Told by someone on one of the websites, and every single it's a quote from Wikipedia, every debunking, which amused me.
Well, as we know, if you try ever put anything on there which runs counter to the mainstream narrative, it gets removed straight away, doesn't it? Wikipedia is well known for that.
My documentaries.
More known for that. I think there's even an Israeli Wikipedia force, isn't there?
Is there? Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, they seek to control it. Well, they want to keep it in Zionist control, and they do a good job.
Jewish people
to do it.
Jewish Internet Defense League or something like that. They are actually paid by the Israeli government to constantly monitor what is on Wikipedia. And
because they're easy to change. You know, they get taught how to do it, but it's not that simple.
Upon migrating, they could take their complete household with them, including machines and instruments needed for establishing themselves in their professions. All German citizens who decided to emigrate from Germany had to pay a Reich flight tax, a Reichsflugsteuer, something that the Jews who left Germany under the Haftarah did not have to do. So the Jews didn't even have to pay a tax when they left. If Germans decided to leave from Germany, they had to pay a tax. The Haftarah accounts also paid for goods imported from Germany by Palestinian traders and merchants. In Palestine, the immigrants received the equivalent in homes, land, citrus orchards, or the full amount in cash. A supplementary agreement enabled merchants from Egypt, Syria, and Iraq to finance imports from Germany through the Haftarah. Additional rules and loopholes benefited the immigrant Jews from Germany in Palestine, among them that all social security and pensions payments could be transferred without deductions. Jews living in Palestine could also make payments to friends in Germany through the Haftarah. The sponsor paid the equivalent value in Palestinian currency at a discount rate to the Haftarah in favour of the recipient in Germany, and the recipient of such support then received the equivalent in Reichsmarks through the Pautro in Berlin. This system of a clearinghouse in private hands for payments of benefits to Germany developed in 1937 into a worldwide organisation. Its task was to organise the relief payments from all over the world and to use the accumulated foreign currency for the transfer of Jewish capital to Palestine. And that's all a quote. That must be a quote from that book she's referring to that's on the Haftarah. Another form of clearing is recounted by advisor to the Reichsbank Walter Uttermol, former director of the Center for Currency Control in the Reich Ministry of Economics. And he says, this enabled a clearing between emigrating Jews and from overseas returning Germans. For example, if a German could not sell his house or business because of the boycott in a foreign country, but found a Jew in Germany who had similar assets, then permission to exchange was given where neither side made an unfair gain. So you basically got all this trade that's going on between Palestine and Germany, and it's all to the benefit of the Jews. It's not the Germans taking it away from them. It's not the Germans confiscating their bank accounts. It's the Germans going out of their way to help these Jews and to help them make a good start in their new country, in their new homeland, basically. Do you want to add anything, Dennis?
No, it's just a question I've always believed, even when people have come up to me and said Hitler was in on it, you know, he was getting money from the banks and he was in on World War II and the defeat. But at the end of the day, this situation was a win-win. As you just mentioned earlier on, no countries were taking any Jews, not even America or Britain. And so the only peaceful way that they wanted to get rid of this alien force, 500,000 to 60 million, was to do it, you know, through the Haftarah. And it made perfect sense to me. But, you know, again, a lot of people, you know, they don't quite understand.
Well, it benefited both groups, didn't it? It was mutually beneficial. And this gets used today. The conspiracy crowd will say, well, Hitler was really working for the Jews. Well, they were both working together in this instance for the benefit of both. The Germans didn't want to have this alien group there. They didn't mind them there at first because they would just have been guests. And some of them were happy to just be guests. But once, quote unquote, world Jewry had declared war on Germany, all these guests suddenly became enemy agents. There were enemy forces that were there that were on the side of this group that was trying to do its worst to Germany. So they thought, well, the best thing to do now is to encourage them to move somewhere else. And we'll do everything that we can in our power to help them to move and to help them set up a national homeland. Because don't forget, these were nationalists, and it was nationalist Jews that identified with their ethnicity first and foremost, more than anything else, that were going to Israel. So they had something in common there. They were both nationalists. And as a nationalist, you would want a nationalist endeavour to succeed. So that's why they were giving them farming implements and all the equipment that they needed to set up their own industries once they were actually over there in Israel, well, Palestine, as it was called at the time.
Yeah, well, the amazing thing is that the Khazars, who were mainly most of the Jews that time and now today, I've never really put foot in the whole of that.
Yeah, well, they're Khazars. Well, the Ashkenazi, their origins goes back to Khazaria, doesn't it? But they do still have a percentage of DNA that comes from the Edomites, the Edomians. And they did a DNA study last summer, and they said something, I forget what it was, is over half of them have this Canaanite DNA, which they were very proud of. And it's in the National Geographic, and it's also in Haaretz. So even though they are Khazars, and they're, the majority of them are classed as Ashkenazi, which is like a German name, really, which means German Jew, they do still have this Canaanite DNA, which is from around that area. But so do the Palestinians. So it's not like they can say, well, we've got this DNA, we have a right to this land, we were there before you. Because the Palestinians have exactly the same DNA as well. They're both...
I think they had a rough deal because they fought on the side of Germany.
Sorry?
I don't think that has been forgiven. The Palestinians fought on the side of Germany.
Right. Well, so did some of these Jews, as we'll hear.
Well, yeah. Well, as a whole, you know, they're there, down there, and I don't think Israel were ever going to forgive them.
Well, they have their narrative today, don't they, which is... you know, which can be challenged with all of this, and they just want to promote that one narrative today and pretend that all these other things didn't happen. Mm. Well, besides the official regulations that applied to the Jews, there was also a number of cases that were regulated through the Havara to the benefit of the emigrants. The Havara was beneficial to those Jews unable to raise the £1,000 required in order to go to Palestine. The Havara enabled them to obtain loans that would be repayable years later. For these individuals, the normal transfer fees were reduced by 50%, thereby enabling every Jew in Germany who desired to go to Palestine to emigrate. I mean, they're really going out of their way here, aren't they? The other Jews are saying, look, we'll put all this money into this account, and any of you that can't afford that £1,000, we'll loan it to you, and you can pay us back years later. We'll reduce the fees, the transfer fees, by a half, so that you can come out here to Palestine. So there was nothing stopping them. Nothing stopping them. Insofar as the basic tenor of the Havara agreement reflected the German government's encouragement for Jews to emigrate, it also encouraged some Germans to actions that verged on the illegal. Rolf Vogel, the former Jewish journalist and publisher of the Deutschlandbericht, which aimed at promoting German-Jewish understanding, reports the following. Quote, numerous individual actions of support were not legal, especially in cases where Jews did not wish to go to Palestine and could not be helped in any other way. It so happened that Jews sold their businesses and then lost their proceeds because they could not transfer them. To prevent this loss, government officials offered Jewish proprietors not emigration, but rather the opportunity to represent their own business overseas. By receiving high commissions and the proceeds from sales as representatives of their own firms, Jewish businessmen managed to get back most of their lost money. So it's a bit difficult to understand that, but it was saying that Jews that had actually lost their businesses in Germany, they were offered a chance to run businesses in Israel while still being in Germany and get the proceeds from it.
Yeah, I'm presuming that there would have been a lot of mistrust around at that time, so it worked remarkably well under them circumstances, to be honest.
Yeah, very, very much so. Another transfer trick, also conducted with the knowledge and goodwill of the foreign currency bureaucrats, was the transfer of money through the courts. A person left at the court an envelope marked, "My last will." The person then migrated, and after a few months would make a request to the local judiciary to have his envelope containing money and shares forwarded on to him from Germany. Money could be transferred just as smoothly by an advertisement in the paper. For example, a Jew in Zurich would place an advertisement in the Volkische Beobachter, "Representative required." He would then have someone in Germany send envelopes filled with money or shares to the Volkische Beobachter, which then collected and forwarded them on to Zurich. So they're talking about Jews that weren't actually in Palestine, that were elsewhere, and they could use this Havara agreement as well in order to get money to them. Like this Jew here is saying he's in Zurich, which is in Switzerland.
And yet
he was able to use the same Havara laws and regulations in order to get money sent out to him in Zurich, even though there was this embargo on all the foreign on currency leaving the country, basically.
Mm.
So all sorts of tricks. And this was done with the help of the German government. They weren't trying to put a stop to this. In some respects, the Havara assisted in developing German exports, although this was not a primary factor, despite what one reads occasionally today. Although one should not exaggerate the consequences of the agreement for the German economy, the consumption of goods by a community of 200,000 to 300,000 people, and the Yeshiv, the Jewish community in Palestine, was no larger than that, which was also limited to only certain goods, was not in a position to lend a country of 60 million people any essential export help. Furthermore, there was no foreign currency flow to be gained by selling to Palestine. Payment was in German money from the Havara accounts. Even Feigenfeld stressed that the export activity of the Havara offered no significant advantage for Germany because Havara brought Germany no gains in foreign exchange. So they've gone to a lot of trouble here to set this up so that these Jews could get out of the country and get to Palestine and get elsewhere, really at their own expense, because they're not getting any foreign funds, which is what they really needed. It's just they're just moving around the German money, as it were. The German money is just
that old German organization, isn't it, really? They call it Germany good, don't
they? And as I say, they don't mention this in the Wikipedia, but obviously these German exports that they were exporting to Palestine, they must have helped them to actually build up the land, because it needed farming. It needed improving. The land itself did in Palestine. It was quite a backward state. It was in a sort of third world state before the British mandate, before this all happened. For Palestine, the Havara brought untold advantages. In the brochure produced by Felchenfeld, Dr. Ludwig Pinner, a former member of the Havara Society, is tireless in singing the praises of the agreement. He says, "Until the beginning of the 1930s, Palestine was an agricultural country with a primitive level of development. It was only the immigrants from Germany, that's the Jewish immigrants, that altered the economic structure and the social composition of the Yishuv, and contributed significantly to its development. Under their influence and participation, industrial output doubled, technology modernized, and slowly the choice and quality of the manufactured goods reached a European standard." And that's quoted from the official brochure. There's another quote here. "The activity of the German Jews as industrialists and investors was decisive for the development of the Yishuv out of its pre-industrial and pre-capitalist stage. Their influence on the development of Jewish Palestine was found not only in the economic and social sphere, it was also marked in the cultural, scientific and artistic spheres. The modernization of hospitals made possible by the transfer made Palestine one of the most renowned medical centers. The commitment of these people in research and teaching institutions, in business and administration, in public life and in the defense organizations was immeasurably important for the preparation of the Yishuv for the fateful task that stood before them." So obviously, I mean, they had a big effect on the country, and this is just not told, is it, that it was these German Jews?
No.
Nothing said about it.
And really, when you think about it, the two cultures didn't mix well. I mean, you know, on the German side, they were Christians, and on the Jewish side, they were pushing in the movie business, you know, lesbianism, divorce, and the paintings. Well, I can't understand one when I look at one, to be honest. You know what I mean? Where the German art was easy on the eye. So two cultures were certainly going to clash at some point, you know.
Yeah, two very different cultures. And I would suggest it was probably the more conservative-minded Jews that went off to Palestine. I mean, Palestine or Israel, it's a right-wing country, isn't it? It's like all the right-wing Jews go there.
Yeah, although I think, is it Tel Aviv, the centre of the gay world?
Yeah, there is that as well. And yet you have this strong Orthodox right-wing element, and it's a right-wing government. But then, they do say that Tel Aviv is the gay capital. But perhaps it's just liberal in Tel Aviv. Or maybe that goes alongside with this conservative-minded bit. But obviously, the German sense of hard work had rubbed off on these Jews that went to Palestine, according to that quote. Anyway, saying how hard they
work. Well, to be honest, if they're going to build a country, they're going to have to work, aren't they?
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's a positive thing that they were doing, and that, you know, the Germans did right to support them. The money of the capitalists, who thanks to the Havara could practically migrate to Palestine unhindered, also made migration to Palestine possible for workers. Dr. George Landauer, the director of the German section of the Jewish Agency and a member of the board of directors of the Havara, stated in an interview with the Jüdische Rundschau of February 18, 1936, "Palestine as a developing country can absorb new immigrants looking for work proportionate to the inflowing capital and entrepreneurial spirit that creates new jobs. But there was the fear that wealthy Jews would go elsewhere with their capital and that only poor Jews would come to Palestine. So Landauer warned, it is not possible to have worker immigrants without also the immigration of employers." And of course, this was the reason why they insisted on them having this 1,000 Palestinian pounds to show when they got there, that they weren't just going there to bludge off the rest of the Jewish community, that they were actually going there to work. We have some opposition to the Havara on the Jewish side. Although the Havara agreement was advantageous for both the Jews and for Palestine, opposition to it was significant. The behind-the-scenes battles are described in detail by Edwin Black in his book. Yeah, I was just going to say, that's the one you're referring to, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were described in detail by Edwin Black in his book, The Transfer Agreement. The fact that there was an agreement between the Third Reich and the Zionists to the advantage of Israel seems to him incomprehensible and unpardonable, and he accuses the Jewish agencies involved of Nazi collaboration. Black's attitude is all the more inexplicable because he is convinced that all Jews who remained in Germany became victims of the Holocaust. Jewish organizations around the world complained of their own people's violation of the boycott against Germany. The welfare of the German Jews who migrated to Palestine meant little to them. They regarded the betrayal of general Jewish interests as far more important. I'll just stop there. I mean, that shows you that what was calling themselves world Jewry, they really didn't care less about the Jews that were in Germany, did they? The National Socialists cared more about them, trying to sort this out for them.
Well, it's like I said, when they declared war on Germany, the idea was to declare war on the Nazis. But the 80 million Germans, you know, the big majority, you know, maybe probably 50 million weren't particular members of the party. So it were all Germans and all Jews in Germany.
Yeah, you're not feeling quite sorry for the Jews here that have been stabbed in the back by the rest of their community in the rest of the world. And, you know, the Germans are actually trying to help them out here and helping them to get to Israel. And then this guy is then attacking them for doing so and saying, oh, no, they should have just stayed in Germany. But according to him, if they'd stayed in Germany, they would have all been Holocausted. So, even this author is... not really thinking straight, is he? There were problems in Palestine as well. The Hawara's monopoly on importing German goods aroused envy amongst Palestinian traders who saw their own existence threatened. This was especially the case with nascent Jewish industries in Palestine, which strove to sell their own goods and revolted against the cheaper and better quality products that were coming from Germany. The Hawara finally had to yield to the demands of the Jewish entrepreneurs in Palestine and stopped importing certain goods, thus guaranteeing the protection of Tozeret Haaretz, products made in Israel. Enterprising businessmen exploited this discrepancy to their own advantage. There were cases in which an enterprise obtained a factory through the Hawara, then used the Tozeret Haaretz protection for its own manufactured goods. As a result, the demand for imported goods and the transfer of money on the Hawara accounts declined. On November the 12th, 1935, the Jewish Rundschau bemoaned this lack of solidarity with the immigrant Jews from Germany. The transfer question is of financial importance for the emigration of Jews from Germany to Palestine, as well as for the transfer of money into the Jewish funds. Without this capital transfer, it is almost impossible to emigrate in style. That this matter regularly comes up in public discussion in Palestine may be due partly to a lack of knowledge of the real factors and partly due to those who wish to eliminate the competition that the Hawara generates out of economic or other motives. So you've got problems there with the producers that are actually in Palestine because they're competing against the producers that are in Germany.
And also the war helped, though.
Yeah, that, well, this is 1935. So what time?
Yeah, I mean, eventually it comes to an end.
And this is when it was still under British rule. So you've also got problems with the British goods that were also flowing into Israel, and they had problems there. And you've also got problems with the Arabs who wanted to produce their own goods and services. So you got the Arabs there. Go on.
Didn't Britain promise Palestine to the Arabs?
Well, yeah, I was looking at this today, and what happened was, after the First World War, and it was a mandate of Britain, they said, well, the Arabs have got this section, and the Jews have got this section, and we will maintain it and maintain the peace. So the British were sort of looked to as the arbitrators in the decisions, and they tried not to come down on the side of the Jews, and they tried not to come down on the side of the Arabs. And the Arabs really weren't happy with the number of Jews that were coming in, probably partially to do with this, although, I mean, it's not that many, was it? It's a few hundred thousand. And they weren't happy with the number of Jews that were coming in. And there was terrorist acts from the side of the Arabs. And then what happened is the British, like, rather ruthlessly put down the Arab terrorist acts. And they ended up upsetting a lot of the Arabs. And I can recall this British guy that was interviewed. He said that it seemed to him that the British were coming down more on the side of helping the Jews than the Arabs, and he really didn't like that. And he said it really didn't seem fair. You may have called the interview.
That's understandable because we have done in the past history of the Privy Council. We were all Jews in England, so. But a lot of power come from England on the Jewish side anyway.
Eventually, we got fed up of it. Well, I mean, we got fed up of the Arabs fighting with the Jews at the end of the Second World War. And by that time, the Jews had started attacking the British as well. And we just said, yeah, like, we've had enough of this. We're going to leave it to the UN. The UN can manage it.
What was that famous hotel? What was
it? King David.
That's the one, yeah, where British soldiers killed them.
Yeah, British soldiers killed there, and there were British soldiers that were hanged. The reason for that is because it was all to do with these numbers, because the Arabs didn't want more Jews emigrating there. And at the end of the war, Britain said, right, no more Jews. In fact, at the start of the war, because of this problem, the British said, right, no more Jews can come to Palestine. It's already got too many of them. And the Jews were not happy about that. And then after the war, this continued and Britain said, no, you can't have any more Jews coming in there. And so the Jews that were there started forming these terrorist groups, the Irgun and the Sturmgang.
Right, yeah. You've come back,
yeah, one of them did. Yeah. And then they started attacking the British But that's what it was down to, was these numbers, because the British were trying to say, look, you've got to stick to this agreement and you're going to upset the Arabs if you keep bringing more and more Jews in. Mm. So in actual fact, I mean, Germany's trying to bring these Jews into Palestine, but it's all contingent on whether the British are going to allow them in anyway, in the first place.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. We should leave that there, Dennis, I think, and next week we'll get into the German opposition to the agreement, okay. I think. So thank you very much for coming on today.
No problem.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.